As Black Lives Matter protests continue for 4 straight weeks, activists are calling for the end of policing as we know it. Most of the violence that has galvanized this movement involves these horrifying scenes of Black people murdered on the streets by police. Mike, as an appellate lawyer who works with clients on death row and having spent many days visiting prisoners at San Quentin, you have for years advocated for ending the death penalty. Over the course of your work, how have you come to understand abolitionism as a movement, one that includes abolishing the death penalty but is much more far-reaching in its vision of criminal justice?
Yeah, it's become an organizing principle about how I think about the criminal justice system and about society at large. It wasn't like that when I began practicing law in the area of prisoners' rights in the early 70s. Back then, well, there were three types of people doing prisoners' activities.
When you say prisoner activities, you mean addressing reforms or the politics of...
Yeah, people from the outside working with prisoners in different ways. One way was to work with them individually, to help them, supply them with books, meet with them, with emotional, financial support. Another way, the way that I was doing it, was sort of like the ACLU, fighting for prisoners' individual rights, the freedom of expression, to receive books and mail, to even hold meetings inside prisons. When I started working for prisoners in the early 1970s, there were three types of other people working with prisoners. There were what you might call handholders, or people working with individual prisoners, helping them financially, helping them spiritually, meeting with them.
That include chaplains that are very active?
Or just friends or people who want to do something concrete with a real person. And then there were people like me who were suing to enforce prisoners' rights, prisoners' freedom of expression, the right to receive literature through the mail, the right to write letters, a host of different particular constitutional rights to have them live inside prison walls. Then there was a third group, the abolitionists, and they were relatively minor, out on the edge. It was one book called Instead of Prisons, published by the Friends Service Committee. They
Wasn't this also
there.
During the time of the Attica uprising and uprisings among prisoners themselves calling for reforms? Even here in Oregon, there was an uprising at the Oregon State Penitentiary in 1968. So was some of this work driven by the rebellions within prisons themselves?
Yeah, prison reform and prisoners' rights enjoyed a moment, but only a moment. And they pretty quickly got swamped with what we now call mass incarceration. There was a real increase in crime in the 60s and early 70s because the population was young and crime is a young man's game. And the response was terrific, strong, and prisons began to mushroom. Prisons began to take over more and more parts of the state's economy. Like Oregon now spends 10 times a greater percentage of its income on prisons than it did in the early 70s. California went from 28,000 people in prison to 160,000 people in prison. The National Employment Center estimates that there are now 70 million people in this country who have been convicted or arrested, who have marks on their employment record, which has forced them into an informal economy of gardeners, sweatshop workers. That is what has made me become aware that it's got to stop.
As you have the expansion of the criminal justice system, against that horrific baseline, even modest reforms can seem quite radical, like what people are calling for now. That sounds radical by some historical standards, is not so radical. And in that sense, do the modest reforms of cutting $10 million here and there from the police budgets simply reinforce the idea that this is the baseline bad news of our existence, that we have this massive criminal justice system? You chip away at the edges of it.
Well, that's why I like the concept of abolition, because that is a total organizing principle. To really, truly abolish prisons, we would have to redesign society. We'd have to create institutions to deal with young children, to deal with homeless people, to provide housing, shelter, personal development, and schools. We'd have to develop ways of restorative justice. We'd have to develop ways of people meeting with each other, as giving people an opportunity to express remorse. Because a lot of crime is impulsive. A lot of crime is not rooted in some antisocial personality disorder. And there's a host of ways of organizing ourselves that would minimize and steadily diminish the need to have anything like a prison.
Angela Davis published a book, Are Prisons Obsolete? What would be your response to that? Does the call for obsolescence of prisons resonate differently now than when she wrote that book almost two decades ago?
Well, it certainly does, because even then, the degree to which incarceration had become a defining character in our society was much less than it is now. She, along with Ruth Wilson Gilmore and Michelle Alexander, these African-American women, are really leading the way in defining a useful movement and showing how truly useful it can be. Her work shows links with the notion of abolishing slavery, but shows how that accomplishment of abolishing slavery was just the beginning, that it replicated itself with contract labor systems and continued with Jim Crow laws and segregation, and that we really have a long, long way to go before we have an equitable, multiracial society.
It's a moral argument, but also the abolitionists emphasize practical aspects of their appeal to communities that are facing hard choices about resources.
Well, that's where Ruth Wilson Gilmore shines. She wrote a book called The Golden Gulag, which meticulously shows California's greater expenditures and showed the way to effectively organizing against prisons by working with coalitions, very unlikely ones, like ranchers and undocumented farm workers, to keep prisons from being constructed in parts of the Central Valley in California. She showed how the prison complex has become overdetermined. Now we've got flat plate steel manufacturers, we've got institutional food people all lobbying for increased prison construction. It's a huge system with momentum going that I think can only be braked, well, according to her, like one prison at a time. You start by stopping the expansion. For example, in Oregon, we've incarcerated more young people than almost any other state because of Measure 11. That's a legal change that could have significant impact on lessening reliance on prisons to deal with what we all know now as an impetuous teenage brain. It would just permanently freeze in an antisocial way by sending people to prisons, when you can easily come up with other means working with teenagers than incarceration.
So with the pandemic hitting prisoners and people who work in prisons particularly hard, like other people in congregate settings, is this a time when the inhumanity and the conditions of prisons can be addressed in a different way as the health problems of not only people incarcerated, but work in prisons? Our governor, I think, is addressing the problem by identifying a handful of people for early release, and this is perhaps one of those modest efforts that fall short of the goals of abolitionists.
True, but it would be really important to do that. Right now, the coronavirus illustrates one of the many, many problems of prisons in that everybody in prison is a sitting duck. And in San Quentin, it's what doctors in the Bay Area are calling a catastrophe. They had no coronavirus at all until they transferred about 25 inmates from Chino, a prison in Southern California, to San Quentin. And they thought they had them isolated and that they were removed from other people. But of course, staff went back and forth. And now coronavirus is raging throughout the prison. There's 170 new cases on death row in one day. It's going to clobber people severely and has been doing so along the borders in Texas and everywhere people are forced to be together. So that's yet another big stick, I think, being wielded against people caused by a reliance on incarceration.
And it's not just a matter of addressing the crisis and testing and letting a few people out or making sanitizers more available. You're saying there is something fundamental about this whole way of managing social problems.
What would we have to do to create a world in which prisons were not necessary?
How do you address the anxieties that inevitably surface and defensiveness in response to calls for abolition of prisons? The charge that this is hopelessly utopian or naive, it unleashes chaos. This is rhetoric of the right wing, but there are other large sectors of society that share some of those same worries.
Well, nobody, I think, is wanting to bang a wrecking ball on the walls to every prison by, you know, tomorrow evening. What we're talking about is a slower process. But I think people also reflexively retreat to the here and now. That is, they say, oh, we can't change, we can't get rid of any of the prisons, without realizing that we have 800% more prisons now than we had just 50 years ago. Sentences for armed robbery or even burglary are far longer than sentences were for murder 50 years ago. The sentences have steadily lengthened as politicians have found one poignant citizen who suffered a particular crime and then successfully got his colleagues to pass laws that tripled the length of sentences for that crime. That's happened repeatedly in every state. So now we have obscenely long sentences. We have tremendous numbers of people serving terms of life without possibility of parole. We have such a reliance on prisons that is relatively new, historically speaking, that did not start really until the 80s. And it has only, you know, reached its crescendo around 2010, 2015. It's just now leveling off. But we could retreat very far in terms of tearing down prisons and not be to the place where we were in, say, 1969.
Yeah, so we'll continue to follow those chambers of horror in the criminal justice system that are perhaps less visible. They're often located in places that are outside of public view in rural areas. And for a period of time now, some of the fate of prisoners and people who work in prisons is getting some news. But what we do about all of that and how we think about it as part of a broader abolition movement and rethinking policing is, I think, with something we can continue to take up.
That's another aspect of prison construction. Of course, the ultimate goal of policing in many cases is imprisonment, if not death. And so lessening expenditures on police is another way of lowering prisons, lowering the number of prisons and lowering the number of people who are incarcerated.
Is there, in closing, are there a few books? Many white allies are rediscovering a lot of literature of black writers, including Angela Davis's work, her wonderful book, a classic, Are Prisons Obsolete? Anything else you'd recommend in closing?
Yeah, read Ruth Wilson Gilmore and think about the idea of organizing the social change around the idea of abolishing prisons, and it's a very effective way, I think, of moving forward.
And she has some fascinating case studies that are reported, including in a New York Times article from 2019. Yeah. Okay, well, thanks so much, Mike. It's Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about prison reform and abolitionism on The Left and the Law.